Are you on edge?
Come on.
We live in challenging, edgy times, so let's lean in. I'm Sandra Bargeman, the host of The Edge of Every Day, which airs bi-monthly on MaximizeU.life and iTunes. Tune in live with me and my friends and colleagues as we share stories and courageous conversations about pushing boundaries, exploring our rough edges, and walking between the worlds of what is and what is yet to be. Join me, Sandra Bargeman, on the edge of every day on MaximizeU.life. Hello, everyone. I'm Sandra Bargeman, and welcome to The Edge of Every Day, now at MaximizeU.life. Are you a change maker? Do you walk between worlds, between cultures, between systems? If you answered yes to any of these questions, The Edge of Every Day is the place for you. In a nutshell, this podcast is about pushing boundaries and exploring rough edges. Through conversations and shared stories with friends and colleagues, it's my hope that we can begin to understand our edges. And what I mean by edges is those places where we are fearful, those places where we are resistant to change, those places where paradox and contradicting identities live in our beliefs and in our understandings, both individually and collectively. We live in edgy, challenging times. We cannot keep looking away from the ugly, from the difficult, and silence is no longer an option. Life isn't black or white, it's both, and I want to talk about that. I want to face the tension of paradox, and I want to engage in hard conversations. I want to explore the rough edges between our light-filled brilliance and our dark, shadowy corners. Because the more we recognize our own edges and get real about them, the more we can help others to do the same. And that, I fully believe, can help to change the world. So thanks again for tuning in. Today, we are live in the hive with our special guest, Emily Thoreau Threat, author of Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief. Emily's books and her body of work reassures us in knowing that the grief process is not one size fits all. How can we learn to reweave the death, dying, and loss process into our life understanding? How can we reclaim our deep wisdom in knowing that death and loss is a part of life, and to embrace it with grace, curiosity, and self-compassion? In this episode, we explore the edge where grief and loss and happiness and transformation all meet. So without further ado, it is time to introduce our guest. Emily Thoreau Threat is an author, podcast host, speaker, and founder and facilitator of the Grief and Happiness Alliance. Her books include Loving and Living Your Way Through Grief, a comprehensive guide to reclaiming and cultivating joy and carrying on in the face of loss. The Grief and Happiness Handbook, a supportive guide to help you reclaim your life while grieving. And the Grief and Happiness Cards, gentle support for dealing with grief and finding happiness. She is the winner of the Book Authority Best New Grief Book and the Silver Medal for the Living Now Book Awards and the Bronze Global Book Award. She is the founder and facilitator of the Grief and Happiness Alliance, which meets weekly on Zoom to write together and do happiness practices, all at no charge. The Grief and Happiness Alliance nonprofit organization was founded to fund these meetings and other services for those who are grieving. Emily is the host of the Grief and Happiness Weekly podcast, and she is a Happy for No Reason certified trainer. Welcome, welcome, Emily.
Oh, thank you. Wow, what a beautiful introduction. I love the depth that you went into with all these different things.
Oh, well, thank you. I like a good bio too. You know, people they feel a little awkward having their bio read, but I love it. I just love it. I want people to know, because we're not going to be able to touch on all of the extraordinary work that you do. And I want people out of the gate to be curious about all the tendrils that make up your life and your body of work.
Thank you.
So thank you. Thank you so much for coming on this show. As I like to do with my guests, I share how I know my guests with my listeners. And I don't have a great story about how I know Emily, people, but I do know her through your publisher, editor and publisher, Sarah Sklarlett, whom I know. This is an opportunity for me to do a plug for edgewalkers.org. My listeners know that I'm a part of that organization, and I've met Sarah through that. And she sent me your books and said, you would be a fantastic guest. And I was like, I love it. The edges of grief and happiness. Those are not two words that we, as you so openly say, those are not words that people say together. And I think that is so extraordinary. And so the complexities is what I like to explore on the edge of every day. We are complex. We do walk in paradox. And so it's great to have those two together. And I'm astounded that, and I'm sure that you are in the work that you do, how people find it so difficult to deal with this process.
That's right. It people just never seem to be prepared for grief. They're always surprised that someone actually died.
Die, right. Yeah. And that we don't socially deal with it. We don't talk about the death and dying process, where we put bodies into things. We don't like to think about them breaking down in the earth. We're just so separate from the entire process. But we're getting into all the things I want to dive into and all my questions for you. But before we do that, I have a couple of questions I like to ask all of my guests. And the first one is, what identity do you lead with, Emily?
I actually lead with being a compassionate person who genuinely cares about helping others through this grieving process in a positive way, to see that there is more to life than grief, since so many people get stuck in it.
Yeah, do you find that people hold on to their grieving process because they feel that they must?
A lot of people do. Other people don't. You know, some people just, once funeral's over, they just pretend like nothing happened and go on with their life and kind of bury feelings and things. And that can get to be dangerous. And other people really would like to deal with it better, but don't have a clue how and don't know where to find resources or help. And so those are the people that I can
that you can
easily help.
That your incredible books address. And before, again, we dive into that, I also want to say, what are the two worlds or the worlds in which you walk between?
Oh, that's easy. Grief and happiness.
I love that answer. The world of happiness and the world of grief. And you are a bridge builder. And yeah, that's beautiful. I love that answer. Yeah. So I'm curious, because in my research, I discovered that your first husband, and we're going to hear about your relationship with both of your husbands, that spurred on the writing of these incredible books, incredible resources. But your first husband, I read somewhere that he did death and dying work within his body of work. And that you are also a nurse. I mean, the correlation. Did you, as a young person, because I did, and this is the reason I'm asking you, did you, as a young person, have a great curiosity or an attraction to the death and dying process?
Actually, I had a unique young person experience with that. And that when I was 13 years old, my dad traded our home for an ambulance company. And my mom and dad and I ran it together. And back in the olden days when that happened, you only had to be 14 years old and have an advanced first aid certificate to go on ambulance calls. And I went on my first ambulance call when I was 14 years old. It was a head-on collision with two families and multiple fatalities. So, and then it went on from there. I had more dealings with life and death than teenagers ever do, I think.
Of course. Oh my. And were you, did you find that you were comfortable is not quite the word, but a sense of being able to be present to it in a way that someone your age, or quite frankly, any age, more so than the average person, just being able to stay present to it. Did you find that out of the gate, or was that something that you grew into?
That was something that I found a necessity because you had to be there now with any emergency situation that would arise, and you never knew what the next emergency was going to be or, who it was going to affect or anything about it, and you just had to deal with it. So I had to keep my act together, so to speak. And then I would find, especially if it was something very traumatic, that I'd find myself on my way home just shaking because, you can't deal with it while it's happening. You just stay in the moment and be present and do what you have to do to save lives, literally. And then on the way home, you think, oh my gosh. That really happened. I really saw that. I really did that. And it was quite an adventure.
Wow. All an experience leading up to this. So, my goodness. Now let's dive into your books. So you have two books and your set of cards, and they all build upon each other. The Living and Loving being the first for our listeners, and the handbook, the Grief and Happiness Handbook, and cards following up on that. So, what inspired you? Please tell us this extraordinary story of how you were inspired to create these incredible books and resources for those who are experiencing the loss.
It was really kind of a beautiful serendipity. A few months after my second husband, who died, a dear friend of his died suddenly. And his friend was a lot younger than we were, and we were family friends with he and his wife lived close to us on the mainland where we lived. And we did lots together, and they had teenage girls, and it was a really great relationship. And one night on his driving home from work, he died in the car, just
Wow.
died. Fortunately, got over to the side of the road so nobody else was involved. But I was so concerned for his wife that I thought, I've got to do something for her. And it was if I had still been living on the mainland, I would have been going to her house and doing what I could. But since I lived an ocean away, I was trying to figure out what I could do that would support her the best. And I thought, instead of sending flowers or something that doesn't last very long, I would support her through the first year by sending her something in the mail every week, sending her a note in the mail, talking something about grief and something that she would be dealing with to give her something to think about in the process and to support her. And so I made these little cards up on my computer, and each week I'd have a different picture I'd taken someplace here on Maui to send to her and send her the cards. But before I started that, I thought, I better be sure I've got 52 different things I can say before I commit to a whole year of this. So I sat down and wrote out 52 things rather easily, actually. And as a writer, I taught writing for years at the university level, that I saw that was an outline for a book. So I got an agent and a publisher, and I got my first book out. And that's what started the whole thing.
Wow. Well, and for our listeners, another part of the story is that your first husband. Tell us about that, how you dealt with his passing.
That was different. I'd been married to him for 22 years. And as you said, he was in the death community. He was a philosophy professor, and he taught the class on living and dying to the nurses. It was a required class for nurses, and it got to be like the only class he taught because there were so many nurses going through. And he was fascinated by it. And it was back before people were doing a lot of things. He was a lot older than I am. And in the 70s, people were just starting to talk about things, death-related things. So he took a sabbatical over to England and worked with Dame Cecily Saunders, who was the founder of hospice. Wow. And he was he ultimately met Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and brought her to the community where we lived to talk to people, and he brought hospice into the community. So he was very involved in death and dying. And with my background, we had lots to talk about with that. And the interesting thing was, with all that, when it came down to his living and dying, he, I think, always thought he was going to get better, that he was going to the doctor to get better, as opposed to really dealing with and recognizing that he was on the road to transition instead of getting better. So that was my experience with him. It's a beautiful experience. He was a great person, very involved in theater. So,
and your sense of how you dealt with, you know, were you with him? How did you feel? How did you cope with all of this? The bringing this wisdom forward on, you know, you're in the forefront. The two of you are at the forefront of all of this. How did that serve you? And how were you? I mean, if I understand from my research, you weren't very engaged with grieving well, as we might think of it today.
Yeah, we talked about things like that because of what he did. He and a friend who was a marriage family child counselor held a bereavement group in that community because there were no other bereavement groups at all at that time. And we'd always talk about what he was doing there. So we had lots of conversations about it. It wasn't like, you know, he was a brilliant man. He was a bioethicist. He really knew educationally about all this stuff. But when it came right down to him, he wrote a book called The Ethics of, let me see, Ethics Theory and Practice. And that book is still being used in colleges and universities around the world. Somebody else is revising it now, but it's this book's still being used. It was a very significant book. And he would revise it every around 3 years, and his last revision he'd been working on for about 4 years because of his health, and I was helping him a lot with it because he got to the point where he couldn't type, and so we worked things out to get it, and we finally got it into the publisher. It's the first time we submitted it electronically, and we called the publisher to celebrate and back in New York, and had a great conversation with her, and we're so excited. And after we got off the phone, he asked me if he was going to get better.
Oh.
And I thought, oh my gosh, all this time he's been thinking that he was going through all these health things and emergencies and hospitalizations and everything else to get better, that somehow he was going to get healed.
Yeah.
And I couldn't lie to him. I said no. And he just seemed kind of resigned. And about an hour later, I was helping him get out to the car to go to a dialysis session. And he sat down in the car and he looked at me and he said a not very nice word. And it was a word of shock, like he just something came to him at that moment and he realized it, and then he died right then.
Wow. Yeah.
So that was quite an experience of transition.
Indeed. Wow, Emily. And to have gone through this with two loves of your life. So, but with the understanding of the so the comparison of how you dealt with the first transitioning with as compared to your second husband in terms of this understanding of grieving well, there was a difference. And can you talk to us about that and how that began to lead you into the organization of all of this work?
There was a huge difference. My husband's were as opposite as they could possibly have been.
Well, oh, fascinating. Wow.
And yeah, my next husband was a New Thought minister, which was very surprising to me that that would be who I'd end up with, but I did, and we were supposed to be together, and we had a great life together, but we looked at things entirely differently. He taught me very much the value of living in the moment and about how the rest of it really didn't matter that much, that that was what you needed to focus on. And I thought, boy, I wish I would have known that when I was grieving shock. It would have really helped me. But I learned to live that way. And even though both husbands died from the same thing, they both were very ill the last 2 years of their lives. Ron did not have any of the diagnoses that Jacques had had when I first knew him. So this all came after we were married, that I realized that I was getting into the same situation again. And one of the things that happened was Jacques was on dialysis, and it was a miserable process for him. He had all kinds of complications, frequent hospitalizations. He was sick all the time and didn't feel good all the time. And I talked to Ron about that, and we had really deep conversations about it. And I said, I want you to know that if it comes to the point where I need to decide whether or not to go on dialysis, the answer is I'm not going on dialysis, and I need you to support me in that. And he said, actually, I choose not to either. And then when it came down to it with Ron, there was an emergency situation about something else, and they just kind of started it without talking to us or permission or anything else, assuming that that would be what he wanted. And with dialysis, once you start it, you can't stop it. If you stop it, that means you're going to die in a few days. So that was a really big thing to deal with,
Oh
especially since the
my.
hospital had all of his paperwork that said exactly what
They
he
do
wanted,
not
and
exactly.
no question about it. They had all of that. His doctor knew that, but his personal doctor, of course, wasn't at the hospital. And they did that, and it was horrendous.
Yeah.
So it led to all co kinds of things we don't have time to talk about here, but it ultimately led to the point where, again, he had the choice. He'd been in the hospital for a week. He'd lost 35 pounds in that week. He
Oh
was
my.
absolutely miserable, and he'd been having so many complications with the dialysis that he really didn't want to be on it. And the doctor came in the room, and he asked the doctor, "What are you going to do for me?" And the doctor said, "Well, we'll try this and that." And Ron said, "You already did that. Didn't make any difference. Are you going to be able to help me? Are you going to make a difference?" And the doctor kind of hemmed and hawed around, and he said, "Okay, then I'm going home." And he said, "You can't go home. You realize what will happen if you go home, and you can't have dialysis and all that, and you're leaving against medical advice. So we're not going to send you home with any medications," threatening him. And he said, "I'm going home." And
Oh,
so he did.
literally and figuratively.
Yes, absolutely. And fortunately, we had a friend of ours who was a hospice nurse, a good friend. And I called her and I said, "Look, this is what the situation is." And by the time we got home on a Friday night, She'd already had a hospital bed delivered, had round-the-clock care set up for us, and she had the hospice doctor was there, even though he didn't want to go on hospice yet. The hospice doctor came at her request to give him those prescriptions that the doctor wouldn't send him home with.
Wow.
And 2 days later, he said to me, "Okay, I'm not going to resist hospice anymore. There's no reason not to. And so let's call him and get it set up." And I said, "Okay." And the last week with him was an amazing, amazing experience. Everybody that he knew that could get to the island flew over and stayed with us. And we had people sleeping on air mattresses and neighbors' houses and everything else so they could all be together. And it was kind of like a celebration all week long. And in the process, he called everybody that he couldn't see in person that couldn't get there so that he could say goodbye. And it was just beautiful. And then eventually he just went to sleep and didn't wake up. And that was a week after he left the hospital.
Oh, the beauty of that. Oh, the story just so highlights the paradox of how we handle the death and dying. I mean, the fact that the focus in the hospital, the relentless focus on we're going to, you have to live, no, that as opposed to the honoring, the even being knowledgeable about, but in the honoring of the wishes and the understanding that that's not what we need. I mean are you still into, I mean, I didn't see it in when my mother was passing. I didn't see any of that kind of honoring of, so I can't speak to that nowadays. I haven't had anyone in the hospital going through this process, so I don't know. But my suspicion is that no, it's still not honored.
In medicine, traditional medicine, and having been a nurse, I can attest to that, that traditional medicine, the point is to cure people.
Here, no matter
Period.
what.
Yeah. Doesn't matter what happens.
Yeah.
And in the real world,
Okay, we
it's
should say
we
keep them
should.
alive no matter
Yes.
what.
Yeah, keep them alive no matter what. And in the real world, we should be realistic about the fact that everybody dies.
Yeah.
Everybody dies, and you can't prevent the deaths of everybody.
And it took we go ahead. Yeah.
No, it just you can't imagine a
You.
world where you couldn't die and you just kept getting sicker and having more horrible problems, you know?
Yeah. Well, and this brings up the whole subject of judgment and how, I think of my aging mother-in-law who, and my father and in the choice of leaving and the pressure to stay alive that we. That everyone at the end of their life, I know, feels. And oh my, wow. What, and the celebration that Ron was able to have, and the honoring and the loving sharing with those who were special that came in to celebrate. And yeah, as opposed to sad and alone.
Yeah, and it was through all that and seeing the contradictions and things that go on, I became even more compassionate for other people who were dealing with death and dying issues. And I didn't know what I wanted to do at that point after Ron died. We'd only lived on the island for 2 years, and I didn't know a whole lot of people. And people were saying, "Well, aren't you going to come home now?" And I go, "No, I am home now." And I just was trying to figure out what I was supposed to do next, and searching for my life's purpose.
Yes.
I was doing a lot of writing, not for anybody else, but for me to just explore all that. And the more I did it, the more I thought this writing is helping me so much. I could help other people by showing them how they could write to help them deal with their grief. And that's kind of what got it all started.
And right, and because then that started, then your friend went through what she had, and oh, well, folks, run, don't walk. These books are quite extraordinary. I The handbook, I wish I had had this handbook for so many instances. And I know that I rest assured that everyone who has read your books, and in particular, the Grief and Happiness Handbook, wishes that they had it for gifts for the people in their life. So she has put together, first of all, Living and Loving Through Grief is a wonderful book. The stories, the information shared, but the grief and happiness, to your point about the writing helping, it's structured with quotes and different chapters that focus on specific aspects of the process. I feel as though it's probably a book that you could just pick up and open wherever you needed to. There are prompts for journaling, things to think about. I loved the fact that you had a chapter that deals with these are things not to say to somebody who's grieving. I loved that. I mean, and again, which that just reflects how unsocialized we are. And how tongue-tied people are about what to say when someone is grieving.
Yes, so often people say something that if they really thought about what they were saying, they probably would never say it. But I was just talking to somebody today who said something about how her child was in a better place.
Oh,
And I thought,
oh dear. Oh.
think about what you just said, you
Yes.
know.
Hello.
Yeah. And they do that sort of thing. And they're not
It's not
wishing any
malicious.
harm. It's they've heard somebody else say it, and
Right.
it's what comes to them, and they don't know anything else to say.
Yeah,
And there's a
because we don't have,
whole lot of things like that. Yeah.
because we just don't have these honest conversations. I mean, can you imagine in high school having this class and discussing these kinds of things, right after we have our finances class where we learn how to, the things that we really deal with in life?
Yeah, the real world stuff.
Yeah, but also, I mean, the whole sense of, it surprises me that religious traditions even don't, it's so separate, and so, there's only a handful of people who have the ear of God that know how to handle this situation, and you are not one of them. And so we get shut down in this process. Another chapter in this fantastic book, people, is I loved that you had a chapter on get your affairs in order. That was fantastic too. I mean, there's everything in this book. Get your affairs in order. How has that played out in your life, or in situations? Do you have any stories to tell that could enlighten people about
Yes.
that? Yes.
Actually, I have lots, but the one big one was my mom. My dad died suddenly, and she was angry at him for doing that. You
Of
know, because
course, of course.
they had planned to die at the same time, and they didn't, and she was disappointed. And they'd been married 53 years, so it was really an expectation they had. And I always respected my mother. She was a very independent person and took care of things. And she and dad always took care of things. I didn't have anything to worry about. So I didn't realize what she wasn't doing. We lived an hour away and I didn't see her very often. And she wasn't about to tell me that she had any issues. And I'm not sure that she realized that she had any issues. But when she finally had a medical emergency and I was called in and I started looking around, I was going, oh my gosh, what a mess this is. And I had to, and she wasn't mentally capable of really helping me a whole lot. So I just had to figure out everything on my own. And it was quite a challenge. And an example of the shape she was in, back in those days, there was a Reader's Digest condensed book that came out every month that had
Oh,
condensed
I
books in
remember
it.
it. Yeah.
Yeah, and mom loved them and she'd subscribed to them for years. Well, she was still subscribing to them, but hadn't opened any of the boxes. I had years of boxes of those books. And had I noticed that, I would have known that something needed to be done. But she didn't put them out where I could see this huge pile of boxes. And it reflected how far back it was that she hadn't been taking care of things. And they lived in the place that when they bought the ambulance company, a house came with it on the property, and she still lived in that house, and it was totally paid for. So she didn't have house payments. The company paid for the bills for the property, like water and all that sort of thing. So she didn't have that kind of bills to do. So nobody noticed that she wasn't keeping up with things
Other
financially.
yeah.
And trying to figure that out was a nightmare. It was very, very hard. And her problems were caused by a brain tumor that she had that was inoperable. And during that time, she had several sisters and a brother. And one of her sisters came to me and said she was divorced and had one child who had brain damage in an accident, so he couldn't really help her. And so she told me after one of my other aunts was killed in a car accident, she said, "I think I better tell you something." She says, I've put you on all my papers as the person to contact and the person that's in charge of everything, and you have my power of attorney and everything." And I said, "When did you do that?" When I got to looking at the stuff, she'd done it like 5 years before and just didn't get around to telling me about it. But I ended up, her situation was much worse than my mother's, and I ended up having to become her conservator and take care of her because she ended up with the same brain tumor that my mother had. And it was such a challenge. So between the two of those, I tell everybody, get your own affairs in order. Make sure that somebody knows what your passwords are, where all of your money's being held, everything. You've got to know everything, and somebody else has to know it, whether you're a private person or not. Somebody else has to know that. Whether you're healthy or not, somebody else has to know that.
Oh, it's just this, the resources listed in this book are extraordinary. And again, the writing. You had a connection with theater. Have you explored anything theatrically in terms of this work?
Actually, the first play I directed was now I can't say the name of it, but it was about a hospice that was up in the mountains that had places that families could go together, and there were three different hospices and all the interactions and everything there. And that just happened to be the first play I ever directed.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
That's incredible. You are so called to this work. It's extraordinary. Wow. Well, so what are some of the practices that you can share with our listeners as well as run, don't walk, and get this book, people? But what are some of the practices that you can share right now that can guide people
Right now,
in dealing with this death and
and
dying
with all the death
process?
and dying and everything, the very first thing is self-care and all of this, because it's like that thing that they tell you about putting the oxygen mask on you first in the planes. If you don't take care of yourself first, you can't take care of anything else. And so take care of yourself, be in good shape as far as your health, have your affairs in order. And journal, write about all this stuff. I really believe in the power of journaling. It's
Yeah, I as well.
amazing.
It really is. I tell all of my clients absolutely the power of journaling.
Yes, it's just critical. I've got right next to me here, I have these two giant boxes of my filled journals. That when I teach, I love teaching journaling, and when I teach them, I
Oh,
go, "Oh,
lovely.
I use this journal for this and this journal for this," so that there's something there that's going to inspire everybody. One person's not going to be inspired by all the things I do, but hopefully people will be inspired by how they can incorporate it into their life in a way that works for them. And I think that's really important. And to get clear on your own thoughts about your own death. Do things like make plans for what you want to have done with your remains.
Yeah.
Don't make your family make that decision.
Well, I love the message of this, that not only can you expand your understanding about the death and dying process and how grief can crack you open to having more joy in your life and more happiness, but you can also utilize that in understanding how you will serve people dealing with their death and dying and loss process. I love that message.
It's all intertwined.
Indeed.
You know, it truly is. And we often, most people don't look at it that way.
Yeah. Yeah, they're more than likely afraid to look at it that way. And if I push it away long enough, then I don't have to, I really won't have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to also touch on, and are you teaching still?
No, as a matter of fact, I just quit teaching because I had done it for so many years and I love doing it so much.
I can feel that for
yeah,
you. Absolutely.
was an online teacher for the university where I worked. And I started teaching online in the early 1990s
Wow.
when other people hadn't thought of it yet.
Wow. You
So,
weren't waiting for COVID.
No, I did a whole lot with that. I ended up, after I'd been teaching for a few years, UCLA opened a postgraduate program in online education that I could take to learn how to teach online. And I did. I was in their very first class and got that postgraduate certificate and got a position at another university besides the one that I taught at to help develop curriculum for them so that they could develop that kind of a program. They liked so much what I'd been doing in that class that they hired me to write curriculum for them. So I've been very involved in online teaching for many, many years, and I loved it. And I really didn't want to give it up because I was still teaching in California, living here in Hawaii. And I love interacting with the students. I loved what I could do with them. But I got to the point where I was doing so much between the alliance, the podcast, the writing, the everything that I was
Yes.
doing. There were only so many hours in a day. And I thought, at this point in my life, I really want to focus on this new stuff that I'm doing and let somebody else take over the other stuff that can't, because there's lots of people out there that can do that kind of teaching now. And there aren't a lot of people out there that are doing what I'm doing. Like whenever I say
Indeed.
grief and happiness, people go, those two words don't go
Gotcha.
together.
Oh, well, that's the perfect thing to come back to. Well, and I also want to talk, you mentioned death cafes. So a death get let's create a death cafe about weaving. How do you discuss the grieving process joined with finding happiness?
It's so cool. I love death cafes. When shortly after Ron died, somebody that I had met here on the island said, "You need to go to a group." And I said, "No." I said, "I don't want to go someplace where people sit around and cry.
Yeah.
I can't handle that. All it would do is make me cry,
Yeah.
and I don't need that right now." And so she invited me to another group where they just sat around and talked about dying. And that one I could handle. And I went to that and it was interesting. And the person who was running that had the Death Cafe here on Maui. And so I started going to that and it was very interesting. I'd researched Death Cafes and they said they always served cake there. And I thought, well, that sounds like fun to me. But the Death Cafe that I went to was at a Mexican restaurant and they had nachos and cerveza or margaritas.
Of course, yes.
And that was interesting when I went there, and I found there was a range of ages that people, it wasn't people think of anything that has to do with death or grief or anything as
Old
old.
and crusty.
Yeah. And this had a wide range of ages, and it was
Fabulous.
very interesting. And we talked about good things about the people that had transitioned, and things that we missed about him, and just it kind of reminisce and talk about how you wish, oh, I wish he would have been here for this or whatever it was. And it was quite beautiful. And I really liked that. And I ended up taking over the facilitation of it, because the person who was doing it was doing so many different things that it was one less thing for him to do. And then the pandemic happened and we couldn't get together anymore. So
I hear that. Well, I have a salon space on my property here in the Catskills.
Ooh. Ooh.
I know, totally. I've reimagined my 1,000 square foot garage to, and I call it The Plum. And we've had house concerts in there. We've had solo theatrical performances.
Oh, wow.
I've done weddings in there, small elopements. Yeah, my husband wants to do poetry in there. But when I saw Death Cafe, I thought, wouldn't that be a spectacular event to have in there? To your point, intergenerational, getting people to talk about their loved ones in a way that, you know, and helping people to be comfortable. I remember when people in my life have passed, particularly my mother, who was the most important person who's died in my life thus far, knock on wood, people were afraid to say anything about her for fear of me crying. And I thought, that's,
let me
again,
cry.
That's
Yeah.
Exactly. I want to cry this. I want to feel this. It's helpful. It's washing my feelings. And the sense of that exchange and being able to talk about those kinds of things, navigating the emotions and navigating the comfort with talking about it, and the comfort with just sharing that with one another in a death cafe, in any kind of conversation, is so key, is re-socializing people to being comfortable with dying.
Yes, absolutely. And they can be. They need to realize they can be. I think people don't think they can be. But
yeah.
You can become comfortable with the reality of life and death.
Yeah. And I have so much more I want to ask you, but we are coming to my goodness, we are coming to a close. This is always the way it goes. I just have a million questions for my guests. I want to talk more about all of these things. And I'm sure that my listeners want more from you, but they're just going to have to run, not walk, to purchase your book, your books, and your card deck, and listen to your incredible podcast. I listened to a few of the episodes. I loved the mix of all of the topics, and again, that your podcast is called The Grief and Happiness Podcast. Okay, so your most recent book is called The Grief and Happiness Handbook. And you've got it. It's there on your screen. The other one is Living and Loving Through Grief. And then you have your card deck, your podcast. All of these things can be found on your website, which is
griefandhappiness.com.
Oh, okay. It's not living and it's not.
There is, you can go to loving and living your way through grief.com. That's kind of a mouthful. And you can get to that podcast or that website from the Grief and Happiness Podcast.
Yes,
so
it's right. Grief and
they're
Happiness.
All integrated.
.com. And they can find you on LinkedIn. They can find you on Instagram. All of these things will be in the show notes, listeners. I have one of the things I loved about your book, of course, was that you had, you included wonderful quotes for all of your many chapters. And this is one that I pulled out that just spoke to me. Grief is like an ocean. It comes on waves, ebbing and flowing. Sometimes the water is calm, and sometimes it's overwhelming. All we can do is learn to swim. By Vicki Harrison. That's just so true. Well, Emily, I thank you so, so much for being a guest on The Edge of Every Day. Please, any last words for our listeners before we say goodbye?
Take good care of yourself. Think a lot about this podcast and act on those thoughts.
Amen. Amen. Well, thank you so much, Emily, again, for being a guest on The Edge of Every Day. And for those of you who are new to listening to this, we are now at maximizeyou.life and streaming on iTunes, soon to be on all major podcast platforms. I also have a whole group of 56 episodes that you can find at my YouTube channel, Sandra Bargeman, on the Edge of Every Day when I was at talkradio.nyc before I moved to maximizeyou.life. So again, Emily, thank you so, so much for being a guest. And for our listeners, remember, you are always at the edge of the miraculous. Till we speak again, take good care.